welcome to the latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast hosted by Data Protection People. My name is Ollie Rear, and I'm joined for the purposes of this intro by David Holmes and Miles Dacres. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed that. I thought that was a really, really fun session. Very informal, very loose, but they're sometimes the best ones, aren't they?
Yeah, I particularly enjoyed that one. There's a lot of material that we covered and areas that we discussed in today's session. I think we certainly had a lot of engagement in the chats, I believe. I don't often watch that myself, but I do believe there's a bit of engagement in the chat going on as well.
Yeah, there was plenty of engagement, and it was a very fun session, very enjoyable. So a couple of things we spoke about. We spoke once again about international transfers, TREMS 2, Google Analytics, all that business. There's quite a long piece about that, but there's a lot to be said about it. I mean, that's part of the reason we keep coming back to it. You know, it's a vast topic. We also spoke about energy meters, well, smart meters and smart
cars,
effectively. I was going to say smart cars, that's a brand, but you know, intelligent electric cars. A colleague has just burst into the office and started dancing. It's very distracting while I'm trying to record this introduction. Dave, please keep telling the listeners what else comes up this week.
Yeah, no, for sure. We looked at lonely DPOs and whether data protection is a poor relative of other regulators, such as the financial regulations, health and safety regulations. In there, we looked at case law involving frolicking that can end up in prison, or at least a 3-month suspended prison sentence for accessing information on systems. And we also looked and discussed the fact that we never actually got around to, and it will be coming up, a discussion on the online safety bill.
Yes, all of that to look forward to. So there's also plenty to look forward to coming up with DPP. As you know, listeners, there's always loads of events on the horizon. Next week, we're doing the third part in our DSAR trilogy. Third and final episode. This time we're going to be talking very specifically about exemptions. So we think, as it stands, we're going to pick out the most commonly used exemptions and we'll work through them. However, if there are any in particular that you want to ask us about, that you'd like to hear about, do get in touch. Get in touch, suggest them on any of the socials, and we'll make sure to pick them up. And more broadly, if you've got any suggestions about how we can improve this particular podcast or any topics you'd like to hear about, please do get in touch. Is there anything else on that front, Miles?
I would say we actually had a submission off the back of the SARS discussion that we had last week. We had somebody submit a question that was asking how you sort of handle a SAR when it's to do with when it's regarding somebody else's personal information. And we had a great time answering that, and we've actually answered it on a blog, and it sort of led us down the path of thinking that this could be a good way to sort of answer the questions from our community going forwards into the future. So if you have any questions, not just related to SARS, but anything related to data protection, whether it's DPIAs or literally anything, we can put together a blog that answers your questions and get that out there as well.
For sure. My final gambit on that is that we're aware that we have a lot of listeners who listen in through podcasts, Spotify and places where it's promoted. But if you do want to come along listening live and take part live and even unmute and join in with some of the conversations around the table, do just get in touch with Miles or anybody in the team. We'll show to get you an invite out so you can join and take part and help discuss all things data protection.
Absolutely. I could not echo that anymore. So without further ado, we've kept you long enough nattering on and being generally disjointed in this intro, but we will let you get stuck into this session because it's a really fab one, plenty of good topics to kick around. So on that note, I will leave you in the very capable hands of Mr. David Holmes and myself. So without further ado, Dave, news items. I mean, there's loads to talk about. The main thing, I think, probably where we have to start realistically this week is further action coming out of European regulatory bodies relating to the use of Google Analytics, etc. So part of all of these NOYB complaints, I think we probably have to start there, don't we?
I think so. Is that the Belgium case that we were considering? The IAB, was it Belgium? And the transparency framework? Is that the one I'm thinking of? I'm on the wrong path, but I might be on the wrong path slightly. About ad tech.
No, but that's basically it, right? It's about ad tech. It's about the European regulators actually putting their foot down in the wake of Schrems 2. So we probably don't need to go over it again because we've spoken so much about Schrems 2 on this channel in the past. But obviously all of that is relating to data transfers to the US in particular. The fact that because of various reasons relating to US statutory instruments, undertaking those transfers kind of fundamentally undermines the GDPR in a number of ways and therefore is not deemed to be sufficiently secure or adequate. And this has really sort of come to a head now because we have had a number of complaints from Max Schrems's outfit, None of Your Business, NOYB, relating to ad tech, as you say, and the fact that things like Google Analytics were used on European websites will be systematically transferring EU user data back to the US, and therefore that comes with all the implications associated with it. Do you think that's a good summary?
Yeah, I think it's a good summary. Actually, while you're just kind of talking through there, I just remembered that I'd actually read something recently in relation to the fact that actually the EU and the US are still talking. I think there's still a bit of a stalemate, and I just wondered whether you feel there's ever actually going to be any movement in relation to transfers to the US, and whether the US will ever actually give European citizens or UK citizens, if we're following a similar line, whether they'll give them any opportunity to challenge data collection practices, really, because as we know, part of the issue under Schrems was the fact that your rights are undermined. You've got and European citizens have got nowhere to enforce the rights or to challenge things once the data is in the US. And I just wondered if you felt or you thought that may be changing, or whether there actually is a solution to it.
Well, that's one of the very big points, isn't it? The latter one, which we haven't mentioned up until this point, but it's probably worth doubling back over for a second, which is that part of the issue, really, sorry, I'm just getting a little bit of feedback. There we go. Part of the issue is not just that, from a security perspective, that it's undermined. As you quite rightly say, one of the big issues is that if you did want to bring a complaint as an EU citizen, you'd have no mechanism really to do that, and you'd have no mechanism to basically enforce your rights. There's no ombudsman that you could go to. And I think that's one of the big issues, and this is one of the things that's being challenged. In terms of, just to come back to your question, because I'm not trying to dodge it, I promise, as to whether there will ever be, you know, another mechanism like that, one has to assume that it's being worked on. However, whether it can actually work, I don't know, because the fundamental problem at the end of the day is to do with US statutory instruments, right? Like, that's one of the big things, and the setup of the US legal system, and that's not something that you can shift overnight. I know that there's a lot of work being done to try and come to some sort of accord, but I don't know. I don't think it's close. I think it's incredibly difficult. Without wanting to flog the proverbial dead horse, we've, you know, spoken a lot about the political implications of all of this, right?
Yeah, but whether it's just a political fight, really.
Exactly, and the fact that obviously post-Brexit, do we want to try and cuddle up to our cousins across the pond in that sense, you know, from that sort of stance, or would we rather stick with our European buddies? But either way, you know, we can't really win in this situation, because fundamentally, if we do try and you know, make something work with the US, it's going to undermine our position in Europe. And obviously, let's not forget that currently we have an adequacy decision, which is not a permanent one, which is limited in time. So,
and I was just wondering whether they'd ever actually get to a point of either giving European citizens a way to enforce the rights in the US in order to still facilitate trade, because at the end of the day, although it may look like there's kind of a bit of a political arm wrestle between the US and the EU, arguably there's billions of dollars or pounds or euros, whichever currency you want to operate in, at stake, isn't there really? If it's holding up commerce in that kind of sense. And then it kind of leads you to thinking, well, would you be able to kind of go, well, and I'm only thinking aloud, I'm not suggesting there's anything moving in these areas, but could you kind of say, well, if it's only kind of low value, low risk, low impact data, well, would that necessarily be in a problem if it goes to the US? Because if it was picked up in a fighter, it wouldn't really tell them that much anyway.
Well, that's a very interesting point, because, again, something we've spoken about a lot is the fact that obviously, European statutory models are based on this concept of proportionality, right? Which isn't something that necessarily exists within our own setup. And actually, that word proportionality is something which I do think is lacking from this conversation, as you kind of pointing out and saying the fact that, you know, at the end of the day, because the big issue, right, again, sorry to double back on this, but is things like FISA, as you say, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, Section 702, isn't it? Which is basically gives US law enforcement the right to go and tap into any data held by US companies wherever in the world they are. But realistically, is that going to affect any of us? Now, I know that maybe isn't the point, because then you sort of get into a rhetoric which is a little bit close to nothing to hide, nothing to fear sort of territory, which obviously we don't want to get into. But you do sort of have to be a little bit proportionate about it, because really, what is the actual risk of the FBI tapping into, well, this conversation, for instance? You know,
and that's kind of the, because when I worked in direct marketing, we'd use email platforms. So, for example, MailChimp, which was pushing emails out of some place in the US in that sense. All they've got is my name and my email address and the fact that I received an email content from an organization using MailChimp. Now, when I was in direct marketing, some of those companies were the charities, so it'll just say you've received a charitable e-newsletter. But technically, if you can't get the information to the US for the purpose of using MailChimp, because technically there's no real kind of transfer mechanism that would facilitate that because of the way FISA works, you go, but it's still just an email address associated with a bog standard charitable newsletter. What would that actually tell the intelligence services? And this comes back to the point, quite rightly, around proportionality, and could they ever get a balance on proportionality, and kind of going, well, I'm not suggesting I know where the level is, by the way, if anybody's got any better ideas, then please do jump up and say so, but it's that kind of, could you get kind of a this is deemed to be proportional if it's within these parameters, and if it's within these parameters, then quite frankly, as long as it's secure and the US are bound by a loose agreement, because let's be fair, Privacy Shield is nothing more than a self-regulated loose agreement, then it should be fine. If it's anything more serious than that, say, for example, it's all your health data being sent over to the US for analysis, well, then you'd be going, well, hang on a minute, I've got a few more concerns now about what you might be doing with it in the US and who else may be having access to it and so on and so forth. So there's quite clearly two different ends of a spectrum, and I'm not quite sure where the spectrum will meet. But I think proportionality must have a part to play in it, other than just a political arm wrestle.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I tell you the thing that drives me mad about a lot of this is, so obviously, in the wake of all of this, there is now a requirement on controllers to undertake risk assessments, right? Because they basically need to, well, obviously it's not the same for us, but basically it's the concept of essential European guarantees, right? When you're undertaking an international transfer. So you need to do your risk assessment on your transfer to work out where it is you're sending it, what the risk inherent in that particular geography is going to be. And then, you know, how do you mitigate that? Do the measures that you have in place, are those measures that you have in place sufficient to mitigate that risk X, Y, Z? And obviously, while that is a way of, I do appreciate, you know, securing transfers, the reality of that is, I personally, I think is baffling that you're asking you know, imagine an SME, right, where you've got, as a business, you rely on tools like MailChimp, for instance, as you say, or SurveyMonkey or whatever, you know, to drive your business forward. And you're being asked to undertake these incredibly complex and lengthy assessments. I just think it's bonkers. I can't understand how that is reasonable. And yeah, all right, maybe a counter to that is, well, what's the alternative? Oh, you know, give us a solution instead of just moaning about it. I don't know. Personally, I'd like to see regulatory bodies take action on this and say, look, we've undertaken the risk assessment for you. Whether it's a particular location, whether it's a particular piece of kit, whatever it is, here, you can go ahead and do it. Because fundamentally, you're then leaving it up to people to... Because there's going to be a degree of interpretation to all of this. Like, obviously, there are scientific methods to it. But, you know, there is going to be a degree of subjectivity. And do I know whether the encryption standard I've applied, for instance, or whether... the clauses in the contract that I've included are sufficient to ensure that third-party beneficiary rights are upheld in America? I don't know. Do you know what I mean? Like, so I just it that really gets there's my soapbox. There you go. It's
no,
it's
no. I just,
but
it, but it just I gets agree. I agree because you'd be kind of thinking, well, all right, so potentially you could do it, whether it's the IDTAs, IDTAs or whether it's the essential European guarantees. There's potentially you could do it if you chase it long enough. But who in the world of communists really got that much time and energy to put into finding it as opposed to kind of going, you know what, I'll just avoid the US anyway, because either way, yes, I might be able to do it if I was willing to spend enough time and focus and energy on trying to do the paper chase. But I might as well just... how is it, or have a competitor them or a supplier that's based in the EU?
That's the thing, isn't it? Because, like, I am now, for some of the customers where I'm the DPO, right, I am now getting queries in saying, oh, we want to start using this tool, but it's in America, can we do it? And the response generally now that I'm sending back is, I'd rather you didn't, you know, because it's... because we have to go through so much work to get this to a place where it can happen. And, you know, that's work which frankly, I think is overkill in a lot of ways because, you know, as you said, you want to use MailChimp. What's the risk in that realistically? Genuinely, now we're getting to a point where we're saying, well, actually, it's too much effort. Could you please find someone that's in the EU?
Yeah, so the bureaucracy overall, like if you're not careful, it's turning data protection into a blocker that I spent so long saying data protection isn't a blocker.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. That's absolutely spot on. And I tell you what's interesting about that is that just to bring it back to our original point that started all this, which was obviously we're talking about the European rulings that have come out recently about Google Analytics. I think what's interesting about that is then you're going to find yourself in a scenario where increasingly you get both sides taking their ball and going home, right? Which we're starting to see with some of these European companies. There have been rumblings. I don't think it's anything confirmed at this point. I think it's just whispers, and I'm not sure whether they'd even go anywhere. But we are hearing whispers about Facebook shutting down its European operations. Because
I read that. Facebook and Instagram, aren't they?
Yeah, because they simply can't make it work at the minute. And, you know, I'm sure there are plenty of cynics out there that will rejoice at the fact that that might be on the cards, but realistically, that represents a quite serious shift in the landscape. If you're talking about major players saying it is not feasible for us to operate for European consumers at this moment in time, therefore we're not going to offer our services in that region, that's staggering. It's staggering that the commercials of it don't override anything here.
No, for sure. And I was just wondering on that whether it is kind of US companies kind of trying to force public opinion, because there's so many people that were actually saying, oh, I quite like using Facebook, I quite like using Instagram, what do you mean I can't access it in Europe? You know what I mean? And I wonder whether they're trying to court the opinions of the wider public and for a leverage on and political sway, saying, well, we've got to do something because otherwise we'll lose the fight for Europe.
Yeah, no, 100%. And just to be clear, what I don't want the impression to be is me saying that these poor tech companies, whatever will they do? Because let's be clear, a lot of what goes on with these, particularly the ad tech sector, is you know, repugnant, some of it, quite frankly, and is horrifying. But the shift, I think, is not one which is necessarily welcome. I don't think anyway, because I don't think we should be. There can be positives to it. So you might now start to look at regionalisation increasingly, and if you're going to get a bit nationalistic about it, you could say, well, we can start promoting, you know, UK businesses and promote trade internally, and let's use the UK equivalent of MailChimp, etc. But I'm not sure that it's a particularly welcome shift to say that some of these major players are just going to take their ball and go home because they can't make it work. Anyway, that was my point. I can't even remember why I've gotten so worked up about this, but Dave, please talk to me either about this further or about another point while I check some of the comments in the chat.
No, for sure, and I think you're absolutely valid with everything that you said there. I think just trying to move on, there's a couple of other bits that I've picked up from the news recently that might be worth kind of just kicking around, just have a look at, see if everybody's picked up on them.
Just before that, Dave, sorry, just because these two points in the chat are in relation to what we're talking about, so I feel we may as well pick them up now if that's all right.
Okay.
And then we'll come back around. Just quickly, Matthew is asking the question, which I think kind of is what I was getting at, which he's asking, do you think it's a deliberate move to exclude the US and promote EU businesses, which I'm not entirely sure is a deliberate move, but I think that's probably the outcome, or at least it's a feasible outcome anyway.
Well, I'm not sure if it'll exclude US businesses or whether it'll actually just be a driver for US businesses to set up European operations and try to run it from within the EU soil. I know that doesn't necessarily make them free from FISA, but if they can say it's housed and all the information's held within Europe and subject to European rules and that kind of thing, and try to distance themselves from FISA, And the implications of being in the US, I could see it possibly moving, and I could possibly see whether it's a player trying to get Silicon Valley over to Europe, possibly.
Yeah, quite possibly.
Because at the end of the day, it won't exclude companies. It'll just mean companies will move to where the money is.
Yeah, I suppose so. And I mean, I think one of the things that, and again, we can move on from this because we spoke about it far too regularly, and we all get a bit worked up about it. But I think one of the things that, again, is a bit grating about this entire conversation is that we're acting as if it's only these American companies that are problematic. And let's be honest, there's plenty of statute in this country and across Europe which is just as invasive as FISA, which has just as significant implications from a privacy perspective. So clearly there is a political dimension to it, but
sure,
it's very easy to go, ooh, Google, ooh, Amazon, etc. But, you know, let's be honest, all of these providers will be up to similar stuff.
No, for sure. And likewise, it's easy to sit here and go, you can't do it. The Americas and all the rest of it, and it's all the rights are underachieved. And it's all for negative and bad purposes. But let's not forget, there's a lot of good purposes that are driven by it. There's a lot of organisations that do a lot of good that's got well intentions. For example, the charity sectors. When I worked in the charity sectors and things, they're just trying to raise awareness of the social goods that they're trying to address and bits and pieces. And they're all being potentially hampered by it as well. So it still comes back ultimately to me to proportionality. Yes, there's harms out there. We can move on at some point in this discussion to look at the online safety bill and what that's trying to achieve. But at the same score, there are a lot of benefits by organisations being able to do what they're doing and raise awareness and sell the goods and bits and pieces. We've got to be mindful of the fact that privacy isn't, well, don't do anything, keep the information under my bed so nobody can do anything with it. It's about having choice, and it's about having the ability to enforce your rights, having choice and having clear transparency as to what's going on and having the ability to make your own decisions about it. Because there is a lot of good. Yes, there's a lot of harm that can be done, but there's certainly a lot of good that can be delivered as well. And I think the balance has got to be made.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. And actually, just to sort of double down to an extent on what you're saying there, Dave in the chat asked an interesting question, which draws the parallel between what we were talking about with these US companies maybe sort of packing up shop because they can't be bothered or they can't make it work. And the incident, well, not really an incident, but the the spat effectively, as Dave says, between Amazon and Visa, which I don't know if you followed, Dave. I've not followed it super closely, but from my understanding, and Dave, if you do want to come on and challenge me and talk about it, then please do.
Please do. Yeah, please do.
But my understanding is basically that Amazon and Visa have gotten into this row because Visa have put up basically payment fees that they charge Amazon for transactions, I think. And Amazon have basically said, no, you're not. Visa have said, yes, we are. So Amazon have said, no, you're really not, because if you do that, then we'll just stop users from using Visa on our platform. And we'll just ban Visa credit cards from Amazon. Which, you know, again, in the same way, it's all well and good them going at one another like this. But ultimately, the only people really to lose out are consumers. Because if you genuinely get to a point where Amazon is saying, we're not going to allow Visa credit cards, well, who does that hurt? It doesn't hurt Visa. It hurts Joe Bloggs, who you know, now is limited in his payment card options. So I think it's a very valid parallel, quite frankly.
No, I think it's a very good parallel. And likewise, Dave, if you've got anything to add and you want to jump on, please do. It's your session. It's our session, and I'm sure we're all happy to hear from you. So if you do want to jump on, then please do, just a mic.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right, Ollie, and as much as the Amazon Visa one was financially motivated, which makes a difference, I think, between the Facebook EU thing. But no, the thing is, essentially, it's big players stamping their feet, isn't it? And
that's right.
Yeah. Trying to get a reaction and see where they stand. It's a kind of a power play almost, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's just interesting that the players here are a state versus a company, whereas as opposed to two companies having a go at each other. So that's a kind of parallel to draw, really, I think.
It's a really good parallel as well, really, because if you look at the organisations like Amazon or even Facebook, if you start to go into the really, really big companies like that, well, most of those have probably got a turnover that's larger than some small economies. So it's you know what I mean? You're talking huge pulling power.
Yeah, 100%. I read last week, some of you may remember last week, we spoke about, very briefly, albeit, about the fact that Zuckerberg has suffered quite a hit to his personal fortune. I assume that's been rectified by now at the time of the time that we're discussing this. But yeah, he'd suffered a substantial hit to his personal wealth. And it was something like the dip in his value was equivalent to the GDP of like Lithuania or something like that. And when you when you throw around numbers like something like 140 billion or something daft, I don't know. But you just throw around numbers like that, and you just how on earth have we gotten here? But that's really not a data protection thing or an information security thing. So I suggest we move swiftly on from this topic, because we're just getting worked up about it.
I could get on a non-DP soapbox issue about so much wealth being invested when there's so many people in poverty still and all that kind of stuff, and it's just going to detract completely from the purpose of calling it a GDPR radio.
Yes, and let's not turn this into any sort of platform. Let's instead keep it as a forum, shall we?
For sure. So moving swiftly on. Moving one of the things I know we discussed, we looked at it earlier in the week and looked a little bit. And it's all about the energy crisis. And I don't know if anybody's picked up. I know we have, because we looked at it slightly, but about the energy crisis. And there's going to be tweaks either made or within smart meters that will allow energy companies to start reporting energy use back in half-hour blocks, and therefore start charging more for peak use, ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
If you're using a lot of electric in peak times, and in essence, I guess, you'll pay a premium for that, as opposed to doing a lot of consumption in less peak hours. And that kind of got me thinking a little bit, because it's obviously the personal debt considerations behind that. But then, at a similar kind of time, I don't know which came out first, but there's also a thought about, especially for as there's a move to go from kind of petrol and diesel powered motors to electric motors, that there's obviously going to be a massive hole in the government coffers from tax So then they'll be introducing, or potentially considering introducing, something similar for road charges. So you get paid, you pay your tax based on a so much per mile of what your car runs. And whether that's just going to be then a straight per mile usage, or whether they'll say, well, actually, again, in peak use, if you're going to be sat in the rush hour traffic, you'll pay more for the benefit for it.
Yeah, congestion charge on steroids, basically.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, well, I'll come back to the car point in a second because I think that's an interesting one. But just on the smart meter thing, I'll be honest with you, I'm a little bit conflicted about this because from inherently my reaction is to say, well, that's really quite, I feel like an unnecessary level of monitoring. Do you really need to be feeding back that information so systematically? On the other hand, I think, is it really that harmful? Because ultimately you've got to pay your energy bill either way. It doesn't matter whether you take it in, you know, 30-minute blocks, or you do a meter reading once a month, or even once a year. I used to do so.
I get where you're going from. If it was taken in half-hour blocks for the sole benefit of working out peakage, for ensuring that there's balance across the network and everybody's got access to electric under the network, then fine. If it's actually you're doing that in order so you can add a top-up cost, so if you're using electric in peak hours, you'll pay more, then I would have said that's not necessarily is fine.
No,
because most people will be caught in the core hours of putting the kettle on, putting the oven on, cooking tea at a similar kind of period. And in essence, if you're not careful, yes, working out balance for the network, working out outages and all the rest of it, working out when you need to crank things up because more people are draining off the network, I've got no issues with it. I can fully understand it in that sense. But yeah, then the top-up cost, if you're going to kind of go and you'll pay more in peak times, is that not just purely profit-driven?
Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, yeah, I completely agree with you. I think it's interesting because, funnily enough, I've got a bit of an anecdote that kind of relates to this in a way, and it'll sound like a bit of a tangent, but stick with me. I had an incident a couple of years ago where I'd moved into a house, taken a meter read, submitted it, etc., and then not submitted one for a certain length of time. And I mean, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter because worst comes to worst, you submit one in a bit, and if you're overpaid or underpaid, then you just sort it out, don't you? So it's not the end of the world. But while I was living there, an operative from the energy company, who I won't name because I had quite a long spat with them off the back of this, but they basically sent an operative around. He took a meter reading, submitted it, and off the back of that, they sort of did calculations based on how much they thought we'd need to be paying going forwards. So they adjusted our billing, and I was paying by direct debit on a monthly basis. So one morning, I get woken up by a text to my phone saying that the bank account I use for my bills is about to go into its overdraft. I go, that's very strange. Well, I'm sort of panicked. Why on earth is it going into its overdraft? Everyone's been paying into this account, etc. I look it up. Turns out that based on their calculations, they'd increased the amount I was paying by 8, I think. It had gone from something like 80 quid to 600 quid a month or something like that. And they just started helping themselves out of the account. And they hadn't told me this, or at least they hadn't drawn my attention to it properly. And eventually I did get it all rectified, but I was absolutely furious because I hadn't been told about this. So it raises a point about transparency. Or if I had been told about it, my attention hadn't been drawn to it sufficiently.
Is it often a query about not just transparency, but fairness?
Fairness, exactly. Because I don't expect an operative to let themselves into the house or to be fair, he just said he needs to come and check something. You go, all right, fine, mate, in you come. And he barges in, takes a reading. Well, no one had told me he was necessarily going to do that. So, yeah, fairness. And, generally, but slightly long-winded anecdote, I appreciate. But, you know, when I think back to that, would I have preferred it if my smart meter was consistently reporting back in 30-minute chunks and therefore this sort of thing wouldn't have happened? I don't know. It's hard to say. As you say, because the implications of it potentially ending up with, potentially increased tariffs for peak times is very difficult. So
I think it's just that the ability to, because what would be the purpose? Why should electricity cost you more at peak times and in non-peak times? Yes, like with most things, there's benefits and there's downsides. Okay, there's benefits of knowing and being able to record everything when the peak times are in electricity usage and that kind of stuff. There's downtimes because you get the top-up costs, and is that really fair? You got the downtimes downsides because if that was infiltrated. Because we've certainly discussed on sessions previously about Internet of Things and weakness of security measures and being able to hack into things. I think we mentioned, or Phil previously mentioned, about hacking into, was it a casino or something or other, through the fish tanks thermometer. And those kind of elements. So they've got the downsides, because if you know when people's peak usages, you'll know either when they're in or out the property, or you know they're in bed or not in bed, in that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of personal data going around. And we've certainly discussed them about the Hive machines and stuff, where you can turn the heating up before you get home. Nice. Downside is you've got all the monitoring and bits and pieces that's going on. So there's this kind of the good and the bad of everything, and it's kind of coming back to proportionality. But then using that to go, well, we could drive more profit. That just doesn't really feel right when there's a lot of people against financial hardship and so on. It just doesn't necessarily, using data to that level doesn't necessarily sit comfortably with me.
No, I tend to agree with you. And what you were saying there echoes what Michael's saying in the chat, i.e. you could generate quite the data set for understanding when people get up in the morning or go to bed. But I completely agree with you, by the way, in terms of using data in that way. But if we're not careful, we'll end up talking about the windfall tax, and I want to avoid that because it's really not relevant, even though I've got some pretty strong opinions about it. But I don't know how I feel necessarily about this particular development. The car thing is interesting because we were joking off air, weren't we, the other day, that I'm happy to be correct on this, but I think it's certain models of Tesla with their onboard computer, if they need spare parts, will order them for themselves. So the onboard computer will go, oh, you know, you need a new whatever it is, I don't know, you need some component, let me just order that for you and just help itself.
And I didn't read that about the Tesla. I can imagine that, because, like I said, I've only got an Astra, nothing overly sexy or you would have thought modern in that kind of sense. But the Astra itself would email me once a month saying what the fuel is, fuel burn was like, what the tire pressure is like, what the oil quantities are like. So it's not a massive step to kind of go, well, these are the miles you've done, this is the state of your tires, this is the state of your fuel. Oh, by the way, you're due a service, I've booked you in, can you get me down there next Friday? You know what I mean? It's not a massive jump, so I can imagine Tesla possibly doing that, where it must be linked to some kind of credit account, you would have thought, but I can certainly see that there's that's the next step, yeah.
Yeah, there's some conversation in the chat. Chris is saying that his old energy company said that they would request more frequent usage info, but that he could opt out if he didn't agree. Which, see there, instantly, I'm more comfortable with it because you're being informed and you're being given a choice, right? Which really, I think, is the crux of what we're saying, isn't it, Dave? Ultimately, is the whole point is give people the information and let them make informed choices. And then beyond that, what you choose to do with their information, as long as people are happy with that, then have at it, effectively.
For sure. And that kind of approach kind of really... when the Alexa machines came out, or the Echo Dots and all that, so we're not looking at doing any product placement, when they came out, I had delivered some training, and I kind of said to everybody, so do you think Alexa listens to you? And this kind of went backwards and forwards and all the rest of it. And then somebody said to me, well, are you saying we shouldn't have one of these devices? And this is where the point comes from. And I'm not saying not to have the device, but you do need to be aware of what it is doing and then make an informed choice. That's the whole kind of setup with it. By all means, if you think they're useful because you can shout at something in the corner when something happens, fine. And if that suits your needs, fine. But don't start saying you weren't aware of stuff. If they were quite transparent, they gave you a privacy policy or some information to go and read, and you chose not to read it. You know, there's both sides of this coin, but it should all be about choice. And if you're not happy, don't do it. And if you are happy, do it. But make sure that the choice is informed.
For sure. And to be fair, Dave, we're not the BBC, so don't worry about being balanced and avoiding product placements. you go ahead and earn your Alexa commission if that's what you need to do. Alan pointing out in the chat that Teslas can probably drive themselves to the garage if they need new parts anyway. This is what we were joking about, wanted Dave, is that ultimately it will signal that you need something replacing, and what it's replacing is you, the driver.
Yeah, absolutely. It'd be certainly, especially with driverless cars, you kind of can you imagine, why were you late to work? Well, my car took itself off to the garage for service.
Yeah, exactly. Completely lost control of your machine.
Anyway, moving on, just one more bit about the tech. It's in the news, and again, I don't know if anybody's picked up and seen it, but about the Apple, I keep getting the name wrong, is it Apple AirTags? Apple
AirTags, maybe, yeah, tags.
AirTags are the little devices that you can clip onto stuff, so if you're forever losing your phone or your keys, or as it transpires, you want to stalk somebody, that you can secrete one of these AirTags in a bag, and it basically monitors the location and lets you know where your keys, your wallet, or the person that you're trying to stalk, arguably. Apple's come out recently in the news and kind of said that they're, I think they're under pressure. I think they've acknowledged the fact that it can be misused. I think they were quite clear that it was never developed with the intention of being used for stalking cases and creepy purposes. But they've identified the fact that, yes, it could well be misused and under such circumstances. And I think they're now tweaking it. So that the if your phone recognizes a tags kind of in its area and it's kind of regularly there, it's not doing much, so it'll start to alert you to it. And I thought that was quite interesting. I don't know if anybody else has picked up or you read the story itself, but I know Apple are kind of tweaking. Well, say I know, I've only read Apple are supposedly tweaking things, the AirTags less kind of hidden in that sense.
I think the story I picked up was they're called silent air tags on eBay. So each of them puts out a beep, so you can actually locate your device. But what they've done is they've managed to remove the beep, so you can place it in somebody's car and literally follow it, but it's not beeping the phone of the person, obviously, that's being stalked. So it's almost like a stealth air tag. So you're able to, and they've turned up on eBay for like £300 or £400 to monitor people. And bizarrely, Apple have launched an app, so you can actually search for them if they've been sort of like that element of being deactivated, which is quite scary to us.
I would agree with you, Michael.
Hi, Simon. Sorry to miss your call.
Sorry.
Yeah, I spoke to Paul.
I think we've got...
Yeah, that's okay. I'll just try and find who it was, and I can mute the mic.
That's all right. It happens. We don't need to know what Paul was on the phone about. But yes, thanks, Michael, and nice to hear from you, by the way.
£77. Sorry, it's actually $77.50, so it's even cheaper than I thought. I might get.
Crikey, so you not only can stalk somebody, you can do it on the Jeep.
Yeah.
Oh,
you're right. It's not like the cost of technology is prohibitive. It was only $77, and somebody had the intention. It's not out of massive reach to go and get, can you?
No, for sure. About on this one, I'm looking at that you've sent, Michael. You can even pay in four installments for the privilege of stalking someone. Isn't that nice?
So is it just coming back to Michael then? Is that where Apple's kind of changed, kind of going, well, because we're aware that people can disable the beep, now we're making it easier for your iPhone to tell you, not necessarily the device or the AirTag itself, to kind of locate and identify itself there? Is that kind of the approach Apple's been taking then? Has it?
It is. What they've managed to do is previously the app was only able to deal with ones that you joined basically to the app, like you would with a, you know, other sort of smart devices. What they've done now is the ability to find others that aren't necessarily attached to you. You know, ones obviously that have been planted at the back of your sofa or in the foot of your footwell of your BMW. So there's that extra bit of security. And I think within the firmware update as well, they have looked to try and stop this modification taking place. But as we know, they'll make a change. The naughty people will make a change afterwards. So it's going to be a constant battle, isn't it? But this just goes back to digital, the sort of digital disruption piece, doesn't it? You release something and you just necessarily don't think about the bad vectors it can be used for afterwards. So it's a great idea, unless it's in the hands of the bad people, isn't it?
No, do you actually know how the AirTag works then, Michael? Does it just pick up kind of Wi-Fi, or does it just store the details and then download it next time it's in the location of the phone? Or
I think it's a Bluetooth ping, isn't it? I think they're added via Bluetooth. I'll probably be honest, I've never actually bought one.
No, I haven't either.
I think basically you link it to the app on your phone. I can't remember if that's it won't be via Wi-Fi, obviously, because the device is going to be moving further. So it's probably, I think it might be Bluetooth and GPS. So basically the app can see it on GPS, but you link it initially via Bluetooth. So you kind of onboard it onto the app. But the modification they've made is those that you've not onboarded, so you can actually... It's almost a bit James Bond. You can scan your room with this app to see if there's any AirTags there that you've not placed yourself.
It's
very, very scary stuff, though, isn't it?
Yeah. It's,
when you think about the size of them and how easy they are to potentially conceal in that sense.
I was actually generally thinking of buying one from a camper van. You know, it's ideal for that. You know, if I wake up after a good night out away from it whilst on holiday, it's quite useful. You know, so but or if it gets stolen, but it's one of those things, isn't it? Like I said, digital disruption. It can be used for purposes it perhaps wasn't.
For sure.
Yeah, 100%. I could maybe deal with a couple for some of my mates who have a tendency to go missing when we go out for a couple on a night.
is that when their round appears? Well, where's he got? That kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Interesting you saying
about the camper van, though. It just reminded me when I went to meet Phil over in Leamington Spa, and I parked the car, and I couldn't really remember where I parked it, because I'd moved it because of parking restrictions and stuff, and I was thinking, well, I can't remember. On the evening when I parked it, I couldn't really remember where I parked it, so I just typed into the maps on my phone, where's my car, and it directed me to where I parked it.
Yeah, it's pretty
was your butler on holiday that day, David?
He was Who'd have thought I'd have to drive the Bentley myself?
Dear me. Right, on that note, it seems like as good a place as any to move swiftly onwards from this tracking business. There's a case that I know you wanted to talk about, Dave, and actually I also want to talk about it, which is this case where a sentence has been handed down under the Computer Misuse Act. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, for sure. It's a case in the High Court in England, Wales, and it's Ali versus Luton Borough Council. I'll try and find a link if anybody's interested. I have put it on LinkedIn, by the way, so if anybody's following me on LinkedIn, you'll see the story on there. And I came across it this morning as I was kind of just doing a bit of reading and looking around stuff. But in essence, the claim was against the local authority, so Luton Borough Council, that one of the social workers had accessed the social care database and obtained sensitive information on a claimant, which was then disclosed to the claimant's estranged husband, with whom the social worker had been in a relationship with. So it's a classic, somebody's has got the ability to access data and they've taken it for their own use in that kind of sense. Now, it's held by the court that while the social worker had the opportunity to access the data during employment, that it should not be held when the employee went off on a frolic of her own, which has made me chuckle with the language that judges sometimes come up with in their judgments. And it certainly and I can't repeat what we discussed earlier, Ollie, in relation to my versions of frolicking on their own. But it's possibly the reason why I'm not a judge in that sense. But in essence, it was all because they're taking the details off the system and use it to their own sense. There was a claim against the local authority about this vicarious liability. So it's kind of not vicarious liability, it's dead in relation to breaches, but it's kind of very much off the radar following the Supreme Court with Morrison's and all the following cases from that. So it's kind of moving on to, kind of looked at that. It's kind of interesting because it's probably happening more than we're aware of with people having access to systems and doing bits and pieces that they shouldn't. So it's probably not that uncommon, to be fair. But I was wondering whether, and it kind of just got me thinking, I don't know the answer, so if anybody's listening, that's quite happy to jump in and advise. It was an offence under the Computer Misuse Act that the individual eventually got sentenced to 3 months imprisonment, suspended for 12 months. And although we understand the offences in the Computer Misuse Act, my query came was, did they pursue the Computer Misuse Act because it's easier to get a prosecution than chasing it under offences under the GDPR? And that's kind of the question I'm throwing out there.
And it's a very good question. Peter's just raised the Morrison's case, which you mentioned, vicarious liability. But sorry, I don't want to divert from your question, and I will come back to it. But the concept of vicarious liability for this type of situation is, if you're into that sort of thing, fascinating, I think. Like, it's really interesting how it's developing and how it's being applied. Maybe we'll have to come back to that another time, because I'm aware that we've only sort of got about 10 minutes. And I do want to talk about your point about the ease of proving it, which I think is a very valid one. I think it's, but then again, we were talking about this off air, weren't we? Which is that the Computer Misuse Act, right, and its offences, because I think there are, what, technically like 4 offences under the Data Protection Act or something like that. There aren't many, but they're incredibly broad. Now, I'm happy for someone to challenge me on this, because I've not picked up the Computer Misuse Act in a while, but from memory, it is genuinely something like, it is an offence to knowingly or recklessly use a computer or make a computer perform an action which is prohibited, effectively. I swear it's something like as broad as that, and that's what gets me thinking of, well, is it really that easy to you know, prosecute in that sense then? I mean, I suppose it is, because if you're saying that, you know, council policy dictates that you shouldn't be accessing this information, then clearly you have used a computer to perform an action,
yeah,
which is banned.
Because the reason for the question is it easier to prosecute under that than the GDPR? Because there is the offence under Section 170, well, not necessarily under the GDPR, but under the Data Protection Act 18, there's a unlawfully obtaining personal data. So it's an offence for a person to knowingly or recklessly to obtain or disclose personal data without the consent of the controller. And you would have thought that would have been sufficiently robust enough in this case, but it's just... I'm not sure why it went through the Computer Misuse Act. Obviously, we're using a computer, so is that the link, or is it just the fact that prosecutions are easier under that bit than trying to establish something under the current Data Protection Act 18? Or what? I'm not sure, and it's just kind of thrown out whether anybody had a kind of their own opinion on that, really.
I suspect that part of it is that the Computer Misuse Act is a known quantity in terms of applying it.
Settled case law, maybe, yeah.
Exactly, whereas section, is it 170 or 171?
Yeah, section 170.
Is, well, I don't know how much that's been used, if ever, so maybe that's the thing, maybe it's just reluctance to test it out for the first time. I don't know, I can't say.
I think maybe as well, it was probably just easier as well, because if they've gone via the UK GDPR Data Protection Act, it would have generated a lot more paperwork and scrutiny for the council as well. So maybe because they saw it as an individual breach, didn't perhaps want to go down the path, because you then scrutinise the organisation, process, procedures. I partially thought that would have been dealt with via the disciplinary process within the council, but I think it's just more clear cut with the Data Protection Act. The Computer Misuse Act, I think, therefore, they probably just thought, well, this is going to be much easier. It's going to be a lot quicker. And we pretty much know, we're going to know the result without actually scrutinising the organisation, because UK GDPR would bring the control responsibilities into place, which we have to scrutinise as well, a lot further than a Computer Misuse Act case, maybe.
Yeah, there's also all very valid points. So I was just actually looking further. Now I mentioned about the GDPR under Deprotection Act 18. There's also a defence under Section 170, under Section 173B, where the person acted in a reasonable belief that the person would have consented of the controller if the controller had known about obtaining, disclosing, pure. And I'm not saying that was necessarily a valid one, but I wonder whether some of the defences to Section 170 would have made too much room for argument. Whereas maybe, as you said, the Computer Misuse Act is maybe a little cleaner. It's got a little bit better settled case law and some of the terminologies that used and all that kind of element and whether that's the purpose for it.
Yeah. I was just going to say, Dave, quite possibly. Ian's raised a point which is sort of bordering on what you're saying there, which is there room to argue that a lack of controls in place from the controller basically allows the employee access effectively where they otherwise wouldn't, and then sort of backs that up with a question about whether harsher penalties comes into it. I think it's an
interesting
one. Very
good, I didn't consider that one, so that's quite a valid point. Are the penalties under the Computer Misuse Act more severe than the penalties under the DPA 18 for this offence? I've not actually tied the two together, but yeah, very good. Potential reason for it.
Custodial sentences under the Computer Misuse Act, aren't there? Whereas I don't think that's the case with the Data Protection Act. I mean, one of the points, and maybe we're really sort of getting a bit too nerdy about it at this point, but I was thinking then just a second ago, is there really a material difference between knowingly or recklessly performing an action and... So, because you were talking about the defence, weren't you? Which the defence is, you know, you were in the reasonable belief that you're allowed to do something. Where is that line? And that's essentially one of the things that comes into it. Where is the line between reasonably thinking that you're allowed to do something and recklessly, knowingly or recklessly performing an action? That's a question which is, well, it's not for me to decide, clearly, but maybe that's part of it.
I would have possibly said, because the law of words is knowingly or recklessly, that there's case laws around both of them. I know that there's a significant difference between being careless and being reckless. That's got case law. I can't remember the case law, but it's got case law when I was studying law many moons ago, looking at reckless and where it's come from and that kind of stuff. So possibly, it's possibly all about the terminology, possibly about the offences, possibly about the penalties that's there. It's a case of, well, we'll stick it under the Computer Misuse Act because ultimately it's easier to achieve and the penalties are harsher. Yeah. As opposed to swimming around in terminology that's maybe not been clearly defined under the DPA 18.
For sure. And I think that probably ties into what I was saying. I'm going to stick with my argument that I think part of it is the known quantity factor.
I guess there's a proven track
for it effectively.
I guess if you go into the CPS and say we want to prosecute, and you've got the option of more or less guaranteed through the Computer Misuse Act, or well, you've got a chance of getting it through the GDPR, but it's not proven. Well, we'll go for the one where we know we're going to get a high degree of success.
Yeah. No, exactly. Exactly. We are almost out of time, Dave, and I'm conscious of that. We've probably got about five minutes or so because we started a bit late, so I'm trying to end them a little bit later at the minute so that we can get a full hour in where possible. But I don't know if there's anything else that you want to cover. The other thing that I saw and we discussed briefly off air, we've not had a chance to do your soapbox actually, so we might give you that towards the end. The only other piece of news that I've seen that I thought was interesting for those that might think so is this piece effectively about the fact that the Foreign Office has been or were subject to cybersecurity issues, shall we say, because effectively, from what I understand, they were basically infiltrated by rogue actors. And off the back of that, the Foreign Office paid quite a substantial amount to BAE to resolve this, to investigate and resolve this. When I say a substantial amount, I'm talking £500,000 for, like, I think 6 weeks worth of work or something like that, which is quite substantial. But this has all come to light because someone mistakenly uploaded the tender document for that work to a public website. And when you sort of hear that that's how the leak has happened, you do sort of think, well, it's not really surprising that someone's been able to infiltrate their systems, do you? Because you know, when the ball's being dropped like that, it's not too far removed. But I just thought that was interesting for a number of reasons that I raised there. I tell you what, we've got literally a minute of allocated time, although we can run over. So I don't know if you want to do your soapbox now, or maybe you want to save that for future.
One thing we'll kick to the next UTPR radio will be just discussing the online safety bill that's been discussed. So it's a draft legislation aimed at tackling illegal and harmful content. But we'll certainly look at what that is and what it means next time. The reason for my soapbox today, really, it's just something I really want to get off my chest, and it's I was going to title it "Learn Lead DPOs." So these are individuals within organisations appointed as a DPO, but you're under investment, you're under resourced, you've not got a lack of support, despite that most of that's in contravention of the DPO's role and the requirements between 37 and 39 of the GDPR. Because it all kind of came to light when I was talking about to a potential client recently in relation to the work that they needed and the support that they required. And the individual was getting rather frustrated with bits and pieces. She saw the value in what we do as an organisation. She certainly needed some support moving forward. She'd studied the course to become a DPO, but didn't really have some of the practical kind of DPO in application or DPO in practice kind of element. It's kind of I understand what the law says, but how do you apply it in practice? In that kind of sense. So the kind of soapbox moment for me really then is why is the regulation of data protection or the data protection regulation, why does that come across as a poor relative of financial regulations, health and safety regulations, or even those from the regulated social housing sector, the regulated social housing requirements? And why is DP not seen in the same light as those? We only have to kind of look to examples around when we ask people about, well, have you done due diligence? Most of them say yes. And then you dig a bit deeper around due diligence, and it's all about whether they're credit worthy and things. And you're thinking, why is DP seen as a poor relative of financial regulations and health and safety regulations? Why is that? And it's a bit of a soapbox and a bit of a bugbear of mine at the moment, why that might be the case.
I think it's a perfectly valid question. And I don't really have anything else to contribute to it, quite frankly, because, yeah, I don't have an answer for you. And I think it's a very important question. On that note, we're probably just about out of time. So your soapbox is getting shorter, Dave. That was really quite concise, actually.
I nipped it because I know we're running out of time and people maybe need to jump off with the bits and pieces. But if anybody wants to reach out to me on the side, or even we'll pick it up next time, I'm more than happy to, but it is just becoming a bit of a grey where you're kind of talking to financial directors that won't support the DPO, yet they'll spend every penny to make sure financial regulations are there. And you kind of go, well, you're complying with one law but disregard another law, and they're both regulations and they're both potentially got regulators that can bite you. It's not as if one's a regulator that's toothless either in that sense. And it's just looking at why would that be the case, and it's just starting to cheese me off slightly.
Yeah, well, Peter's suggesting that maybe it's the money. If a company has a bad credit score, then there's a risk of not getting paid. So I don't know. I've no idea. Emma's also suggesting maybe the ICO is seen as having less bite, and I think that is perfect. I'd certainly agree with that.
For sure, but when I've worked with organisations that spend a lot of money and the money starts flowing when there's a breach, and I know we all see it, well, how costly is compliance? We'll try non-compliance. But I've actually seen, I've been there with organisations that have spent lots and lots of money trying to put things right once it's gone wrong, and you're kind of going, well, why didn't you just invest in doing it right in the first place to avoid the bigger costs down the line?
Sure. Yeah, no, it's a tricky one. I think, yeah, buy-in. I mean, we talk about this a lot, don't we? You know, issues around buy-in. How do you get a business, how do you get an organization to really support you on this, if, particularly if from a regulatory standpoint, there's not seen to be a particularly strong pressure on you in that sense.
For sure.
An issue we could kick around for hours, but unfortunately, I think we are going to have to call time on this one. But I have to say, Dave, I thought that was tremendously good fun. I thought there was some good points in there, so I'm very pleased with that one. So thank you all very much for attending this latest session. Thank you all for your contributions.
No,
Yeah, that's been really good fun. Really enjoyed that one. I mean, we enjoy all of them, but this one in particular, yeah, very enjoyable. We'll be back next week with, are we doing SARS Part 3 next week, maybe? We've got another episode next Friday. Miles, put me out of misery. Yes. What's next week?
It's SARS. SARS Part 3, so third and final installment of the SARS discussion. So Carrie will be joining us again.
The SARS Wars trilogy.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's particularly looking, I think, if I remember rightfully, for those who haven't listened to Part 1 and 2, around the exemptions. So if anybody's got any particular exemptions that you're stumbling over, please email them over to Miles or get in touch with Miles and to our list early enough so we can address them for you. Otherwise, we'll probably only be looking at the core exemptions and not less if some more of the obscure ones.
Yeah, 100%. We'll work through the ones which we contend with most regularly. I'm disappointed, Dave, you didn't seem to appreciate my pun there previously. Maybe it got lost, but oh well. I'll work harder on matching your supreme standard of humour that you bring to this,
this channel. And also some internal meetings. I wonder, I'm maybe challenging Phil for the comedy title this year.
You really are. You really are. And you're getting it on record, which is clever. Anyway, enough nattering. We've got to go and record the intro for this. But thank you all very much for your time. Thank you for your contributions. We hope to see you all next week, or at least again in future. As Dave and Miles say, if you want to get involved, just drop us a line and you can get added to the mailing list for these live sessions, and if not, obviously they go out on all your streaming platforms and the DPP website the same afternoon, so you can follow along that way. Without further ado, good afternoon have a good weekend all, is what I mean. Take care and we'll see you all very soon.
Take care for now. Thanks for joining. We'll speak to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye now.